Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Good evening and welcome to the somewhat May and kind of June episode of The Three Horsemen. This is going to be a split episode, and we are bringing the first half right now. Let me introduce myself. My name is Fred Kish, Fred Kish at Twitter, and I am the proud owner of a brand new Cory Doctorow multi-tool featured in Walk Away. So who else have we got here tonight? Do I hear the from Mr. Jeff Patterson?
Yes, you do. Hey, Jeff Patterson, Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter, also on Facebook. And I've got a story, which I'll be talking about later, in a anthology.
And and who would that be?
Hi, I'm John Stevens. I am the splitter. And I'm also a writer, reviewer, bookseller, etc. Can usually be found on Twitter at @erudite_ogre. I have one of the worst blog pages ever. And, I get around.
All right. Well, tonight we're going to have a somewhat of a hodgepodge of various things. Some things that some of us have read, some of the things that some of us have not read, some things that some of us have viewed, and some things that some of us have not viewed. So to start it all off, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Patterson and Mr. Stevens to talk about a movie that I have not yet seen. Take it away, gentlemen. Right.
Well, The 400 Blows was a really...
Now, that one I have seen, so...
I just watched Bella.
Oh, there you go.
Just like Belladonna Sadness, too, which is not something I really want to talk about here. So, no, we'll go a little less cerebral and talk about Guardians of the Galaxy.
Two.
Which, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Volume 2.
I did see in IMAX 3D.
And we will provide a link to our earlier episode in which we discussed Volume 1. Mm-hmm. One of the few times all three of us met in the same space.
A couple things off the bat for me in it. Number one was I want to before I actually talk about the film itself. Marvel, obviously funded by Disney, has been sinking a great deal of R&D into how to make 3D relevant. And doing it in comic book film seems to be an ideal cauldron for trying this out on. And I thought they really hit it out of the park with Doctor Strange, especially the mirror universe sequences. But this movie, they actually weren't so much using the 3D to emphasize the eye candy or to push the scale of things, but more to enunciate distances between ships, between characters, between people, foreground and background, and I thought they did it to great effect. In fact, the very beginning of the movie, where you see the car driving down the road, they went out of their way to make it look like a tilt shift effect, focus effect, so that it looked almost like you were looking at a miniature until we get right up to the car and you see where you are. And I thought it was really neat. And when it comes to a visual vocabulary for anything else, I think they're really starting to find ways to integrate 3D into the visual language that they're telling these stories with. And that was the one thing that really, really stood out for me just in watching it in that format, was that I thought it was a definite visual style to the effects these days. The movie itself, I actually liked a great deal. I would say more so than the first one, primarily because I thought it had a better ending. I never liked the ending of the first one. Secondly, because I thought they did a really good job of splitting up screen time between, let's face it, a very large number of characters and making most of those characters somewhat meaningful, and sort of tying it all back to the theme of Peter Quill and the stuff he's going through. Johnny, what did you think of it?
Well, I can't see 3D, so I can't comment on that.
Okay.
But on a good old flat screen, it looked perfectly fine. I also liked it more than the first one because it still had a lot of the humor, and some of it worked and some of it didn't. But, you know, I think I agree that there was just more cohesion. It felt much less scattershot. It was at a pace that allowed things to unfold a little bit instead of just getting constantly slammed in our faces through a series of jump cuts. And they focused a little more compellingly on the visual world, and maybe that links up to what you were talking about with the visual vocabulary that they're developing. But it felt much less like some kind of Star Wars ripoff in terms of visuals than, say, the first one kind of did, just in terms of there was a bit more richness to things, to places, and I felt that both visually and in terms of the plot and characterization, there was just more room. They actually, you know, let things happen, and I felt that immediately made it better than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, I mean, they actually had an interesting story and one that I wasn't expecting, especially given the difference between the comics Star-Lord dad and the movie Star-Lord dad.
Yeah.
When
you talk about the story and how it unravels, it actually reminded me a great deal of like a really good Farscape episode,
mm-hmm.
Where you've got this ensemble that each has their own little quirky dynamics, and
mm-hmm.
especially, you know, ancillary characters like Nebula,
right.
And Yondo's sidekick there,
his sure.
second in command. I thought they both managed yep. to be very yep. well-formed characters, given how limited mm-hmm. the screen time was.
Yeah. And I like actually how you put that, because the plot doesn't develop, it unravels.
Yes.
And that was also kind of interesting to watch, too, because sort of seeing things kind of come apart the way they do and then reform to an extent at the end made for a much more interesting viewing than slam, bang, pause, slam, bang, pause, slam, bang, pause.
No.
So.
When you say unravels, you mean this in a positive way? Because usually when you say a
yeah.
film or plot unravels, it's not a positive thing.
No, this is positive.
Okay.
This is
interesting.
This is really, it's one of the most fascinating things about the movie to me.
It's there's two things that sort of run through the entire film. Number one, every storyline comes back at some point to the concept of family, which was a tiny bit heavy-handed in a couple cases, but forgivable.
Not a tiny bit, but yes, forgivable.
secondly, everybody in the course of the story loses control of their situation, regardless of the scale that the character is working on, regardless of their power level, regardless of their level of authority. The sovereign at the beginning of the movie who have hired the guardians, they lose control of the situation. Peter loses control. Rocket loses control. Groot has no control until he finally, you know, gives himself permission to have a bit of agency in the course of the story. Yondo especially, it is literally a loss of control over your circumstances. Mm-hmm. And they all kind of hit a sweet spot at one point in the movie. And when you get into the last third of it, it's not so much matters of regaining control or even redemption. It's just a matter of all those sweet spots basically hitting one after another, which is why I thought the third act of this was a lot better than the third act of the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And it did have me laughing quite loudly at a few spots, especially Stan Lee's cameo. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, that was actually pretty good.
So now that was, all these Marvel Cinematic Universe films have been working towards a kind of integrated story, even though it's sometimes the cracks start to show. And the last one did involve pieces towards that story. Does this one also contribute to it, or have they decided to go their own?
I think only in the one of the post-credit or during credit scenes, they basically tell us that we're probably going to be seeing the last of the gemstones, either in the next movie or in the Avengers crossover, Infinity Gauntlet. And I would also say that, I mean, both my wife and I were doing quite a bit of research after this, and one of the things that I did not realize, one of the little Easter eggs in the movie, is that when Ego's plan starts to unfold and we flash back to Earth and the Dairy Queen that we first saw him at, one of the vehicles that's caught up in the mayhem is actually driven by the actor who played Peter's grandfather at the beginning of the first movie. Mm-hmm. Which everybody is assuming that they're bringing him back for the third movie as well. And apparently there was also a deleted scene in the first movie where you saw Peter's grandfather outside looking up at the stars, somehow implying that he knew Peter had been taken. So, yes, the Guardians coming to Earth is going to be pretty obvious, and the cosmic threat that forces it is, while it is in no way center in this movie, it is certainly, they're heavily implying that it's going to be in the next movie. There is no Thanos cameo or anything like that, but they sort of point to where they're going. So, well, if you get a preview for Thor before, which I'm certain you will, mm-hmm. there's sort of a couple hints in there as well, as to the bigger picture. So. Mm-hmm.
So any nice Chris Foss-inspired spaceships or such?
No. Well, the Sovereign ships, not so much. They actually looked a bit more like Stephen Martinair ships. And there aren't really, aside from the Yondo's ship, this isn't really a ship-heavy movie like the last one, so...
No, it's not. And that, yeah. I mean, they're what, four, five? I mean, they're all the Sovereign ships, but they're the same ship. And then there's Ego ship, then there's the Guardian ship, and then there's Yondu ship, and that's pretty much it, right?
And they haven't really told us where they sleep on the Guardian ship either. It seems smaller than, say, the Serenity from Firefly.
So, seems really small, it looks like, you know. Yes.
Now, I thought I had seen a still, which implied that they had finally captured Jack Kirby's look. Was this, did you notice anything like that, or did you see such a thing as well?
There is a couple of shots where they evoke Kirby's version of Ego,
right?
To very nice effect. In fact, I actually almost missed it the first time it happened, probably due to the 3D and the fact that the ship was coming in from the background in front of the camera. Right before the shot ended, I went, "Oh, there he is." The thing that was impressive, though, was that Ego's planet, the architecture and the internal structure of it, were all sort of based on fractals. And if you go to YouTube and you look up Mandelbox or Mandelbulb, you'll find all these wonderful little fly-throughs of these fractal 3D shapes. And what we saw, especially on the interior of Ego's planet, definitely evoked that kind of feeling, this weird little unnatural filigreed structure that everything had. And as you got closer and closer to the structure of things, buildings, archways, you know, it was sort of incorporated into all of it. It was this overall motif, which was just freaking gorgeous. It really was. And that leads me to the one other thing I really want to point out. This movie had a significantly different color palette than the last movie, or even Doctor Strange for that matter, which was very interesting to see. The heavy use of golds and bright colors. And even when characters are in very darkened spaces, much like Yondo ship, the colors really, really popped. Even things like Baby Groot walking around, he was such a rich brown compared to, you know, the gunmetal gray of everything else. And it really, this is something that I've always, you know, especially with like the Star Trek reboots and things like that, the visual aspect of telling a science fiction story is so often given, sometimes it's phoned in, other times it's you know, over the top, something like Avatar. But this was a movie that really used its visuals for the sake of pushing the storytelling, as opposed to just being making you go ooh and ah at every corner.
Yeah,
and it was a very, very neat tool.
Yondu's fin was so red.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Hell, that entire the entire credit scene at the beginning.
Was
just colors all over the place. It was almost like you were watching the ending of 2001 almost. It was just that bright and that searing when it came to the amount of stuff that was going on screen. So the hyperspace jump effect that they did, which we've never seen before, was also pretty cool. The whole idea of jump points and this sort of hexagon-based... they did something similar when they made all those Halo CGI shorts a while back. They used something very similar for their hyperspace jumps, and that was very effective. So
I'm just remembering the 700 jump scene.
Yeah, which was brilliant. So
It was much more visually interesting. Mm-hmm. That's just not a great word, but I mean, they really did do a lot more with the visuals this time.
Right.
And they actually enhanced the feel of the film.
Yeah, they were intrinsic to the telling.
Exactly.
Which the same cannot be said for like Avengers Age of Ultron. Mm-hmm. It can be said about things like Ant-Man and Deadpool, I suppose, which are mostly real world settings.
Right.
But when you're dealing with the, you know, I thought they did a really good job with Doctor Strange, but I thought this movie really, I hate to do it, but I really have to credit, you know, Disney having such a major hand in it, having been at the forefront of so many crazy and colorful technologies when it came to filmmaking.
Right.
So are the side stories in the Marvel Universe better than the main story and the main, you know, the big heavy hitters?
I don't know if I'd say they're better, especially in this movie. I thought that the major characters definitely had a lot more to deal with and thus really stepped up a bit more. Rocket's character is pretty much unchanged, but he had a couple poignant scenes as well. Mm-hmm. The importance of Yondu in the story really surprised me.
That was nicely done.
And Nebula, I thought, even though they kind of gave her, you know, scenery to chew as they did in the first movie, she actually made it work. Karen Gillan is just so brilliant in that role, and the fact that her character's arc through the movie, I thought, worked, even though it's probably takes up maybe a total of 2 minutes of screen time. It was very, very effective.
All right, so maybe a better question or a better way of asking it, are these better entry points? I mean, you don't have to watch Thor 1, Thor 2, Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2, et cetera, when you get to the point of the first Avengers movie, you know, you had to have, at least it was implied that you had seen all those previous ones, whereas Guardians, Deadpool, and I assume Doctor Strange, although that is another one that I missed, you know, there are other points where you can enter without having all the baggage.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
That I would definitely say.
Mm-hmm.
You need not seen any of the other ones to do this. Hell, I'd go so far as to say that even if you didn't see the first Guardian, this is still an amazingly enjoyable film.
Mm-hmm.
Just because,
yeah, no,
you know,
definitely.
I remembered watching the beginning of Serenity when that came out, and the fact that Joss Whedon did such a good job of getting everybody up to speed so that even if you hadn't seen the show, you can enjoy the movie.
Right.
And they did, James Gunn did something very similar here. So.
Yeah. And it's a lot less ponderous, too. I mean, there's sort of this, you know, artificial weight that the sort of main saga, like, you know, the Avengers is part of a mighty saga, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the Guardians is more on the level of people living lives in this crazy universe.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, it's not that there aren't moments that are, you know, really significant. It's just they don't have the ponderous weight
right
on them right in the same way that the main movies do. That, to me, is something that often takes away from the main movies, like especially the Avengers movies. They're just so weighty and, you know,
full of pathos.
Yeah, it's just, and it's
everybody's it's,
better. Or bethos sometimes. Yeah. With the exception of, I think, Civil War, and that was primarily because of the addition of Spider-Man and Ant-Man and some of the side characters, who kind of lightened it up. You know, it was still this, you know, big deal, serious movie, but it didn't have the same sort of ponderousness, and it felt somewhat more lived in and less sort of saga-like than the previous stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about Guardians is that it is an entry into the Marvel Cinematic Universe that, you know, you don't feel like there should be a symphony orchestra constantly playing in the background as loud as possible.
I hear that.
You know, it's...
I hear that.
And, you know, and I think that's one of the things that disappointed me a bit about the first movie is that I didn't think it delivered on that promise, but the second movie certainly does.
Yeah.
It does deliver on that promise. And I think they need, you know, more movies like that, and like Deadpool, which wasn't my favorite movie and that I had a few problems with, but I liked what they were striving for, certainly. I mean, I'm kind of hoping Black Panther doesn't get too caught up in the Avengers line and can be more of its own its own self-contained story.
Given how the trailers for Spider-Man Homecoming have more Robert Downey Jr. than they actually have Spider-Man.
So. Yeah, that was... and Tom Holland is such a good Spider-Man.
Yeah.
It should really just be Spider-Man.
Right.
And all that crap about him taking away the suit and all that stupid crap. It's like, let Spider-Man be Spider-Man for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let him do his teenage stuff. Let him make mistakes. Let him grow as a character. You know, let him be hard scrabble and a little behind and... you know, still win and still make it out in the end because he's Spider-Man. He's just, he pulls it out of his head. Not in, like, Batman's dark way, but in that sort of Spider-Man manner of, you know, a combination of luck and crackerjack timing and a little bit of Spidey sense.
Yep.
That's what Spider-Man should be. And I'm concerned that's not going to be what Spider-Man is, the movie, the new movie. You know, I still feel like the only one that actually captured that of all the Spider-Man movies is the very first one with Tobey Maguire. I mean, the first Andrew Garfield one, I liked him as Spider-Man, but I didn't like the movie very much. And I thought the first Spider-Man movie was really the best because it really tried to let Spider-Man be Spider-Man.
I hear that. Oh.
So there. But to get back to the Guardians... It was really a nice experience to see that movie and to not feel that I had to be taking notes for something in the future.
Yeah.
You know, I can walk in and just say, okay, I'm just going to let this movie wash over me. I'm just going to, you know, enjoy it. I'll certainly have criticisms of it, but I don't walk in going, okay, do I remember all the different strands that have come up to this point in other movies so they don't miss out some, you know, plot point or something? Because even Civil War, which I thought was possibly the best of the Avengers movies, and it was a Captain America movie, which is even better. it had some of that quality, and like I said, I think it came from those side characters. And that's what, for me, that's what I want a comic book movie to be.
Mm.
You know, you know, this reproduction of sort of the kind of lengthy, many fingered stories that are supposed to, they're really just there to make you buy all the comics. Taking that approach to films, I don't think works.
It doesn't seem to be working on the print either lately, so there you go.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, it's not against the utter ludicrousness of both universes, major universes that, right now.
And that is, yeah, that is something else, is that it, while veering away sharply from a lot of the work that Dan Abnett did when he was writing this iteration of the Guardians, it was sort of nice to have this while the Guardians are kind of mired in these multiple really bad storylines that they're in right now.
And you know, to me, what made some of the more current storylines bad is bringing in mainstream Marvel characters. Right. Iron Man, The Thing, the stupid X-Men thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to throw those books out the window.
Yep.
I mean, you know, again, it just takes away from what the Guardians' potential is, which is for stories that are really compelling, but not super heavy, that don't take themselves too seriously, but have, you know, points that you will, that will make you engage. Like the Guardian, for me, the Guardians and the Agents of Atlas stuff really did that in their beginnings.
It got a definite thumbs up from me, so.
Yeah, right. Same here.
Shall we move on to a different subject?
Sure.
Is there anything we have all experienced that we would like to discuss?
Ooh.
Breathing.
About to say, occupying space. A really good bowl of jambalaya once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Cosmic powers. I mean, I think part of the... This is... we're talking about a book called Cosmic Powers, which is edited by... John Joseph Adams, and is published by a friend of the podcast, Mr. Joe Monti's Saga Press, and you will recognize it, if, especially if you are a Guardians fan, by the bright, friendly Chris Foss pair of spacecraft on the cover. So it is, mm-hmm. It is definitely, and it made very clear in the introduction that it is inspired by the sort of comic book or grand science fiction of the old tradition, you know, be it Guardians of the Galaxy or... I mean, Doc Smith or anyone else. There are stories, just to give the quick overview. You've got Charlie Jane Anders, Tobias Buckel, Becky Chambers, Adam Troy Castro with Judy Castro, Alan Dean Foster, who's a, you know, definitely old school, Cole Schroeder, who's more hard SF, Shauna McGuire. I mean, I don't think Shauna McGuire's, nothing I've ever read by her has been space opera. Linda Nagata, soon to be friend of the pod, and many others. So, I mean, you look at the table of contents, it's a great split between men and women, old and new. Me personally, I didn't think there was a stinker in the entire collection. I especially like for example, Tobias Buckel's entry, which is, let me just page back here.
Zen in the Art of Starship Maintenance.
Yeah, Zen in the Art of the Starship Maintenance, which when I read it, I thought it was the closest we're going to get to a collaboration between Ian Banks and Gregory Benford. I mean, that was my one sentence, 15-second elevator pitch. I mean, I highly recommend the entire collection.
It's mostly originals. The only two reprints are the Caroline Yoakum story, Seven Wonders of the Once and Future World.
Right.
And I think the Aladette de Baudard is... Check acknowledgements. I'm pretty certain that was also printed
possibly
somewhere.
Possibly the Alan Dean Foster. I know there were two or three that said copyright 2015. So I assume those were not the reprints. But yeah. I mean, those were the reprint stuff.
Right, and especially the Caroline Yoakum story. I love. I've always loved that story since I first read it. Mm-hmm. He says in the introduction. He specifically says the Marvel Universe, the Mad God Thanos, Celestials, Galactus, High Omnipotent. I was always chasing that sense of wonder high, eventually moving on from comics to science fiction and fantasy novels. And so he's sort of setting himself a very high bar at the beginning of this book, saying that that's what he's trying to capture. And I would agree that there was a couple stories in here I wasn't crazy about, but for the most part, they are all very good stories. However, I don't think they really all manage to set the bar that he sets at the introduction. Quite a few of them do. without a doubt, longer pieces sort of work, and certainly Yun Ha Lee and Linda Nagata and a few others. I really like The Sighted Watchmaker by Vilar Kaftan. I thought that was a fantastic story. Mm-hmm. What kind of, as I started it, I read it through in order. And so I get out of the introduction and I go, wow, this should be interesting, and immediately turn the page and begin the Charlie Jane Anders story, A Temporary Embarrassment in Space-Time. And by the time you get to the end of page 2 of this story, it's kind of obvious that the story is going to be told with a veneer of snark and a touch of irony. And as you get deeper into the story, my interpretation of this was that Anders was telling us that this type of story cannot be told unironically. And I was a little irked by that, especially for the first story in a collection. It's a good story. I actually liked the plot of it and could actually see how in the hands of Peter F. Hamilton or Dan Simmons or Catherine Asaro, this exact same story could have been told in a really sweeping way. It actually sort of reminded me a little bit of the S. Andrew Swan Apotheosis trilogy and sort of the way it was paced and the way the story unfolded. But there was this constant, through the naming of things, through the exclamations that the characters make, through the weird hive mind and the way it played out. Some points of it were obviously done for laughs. Other points of it weren't particularly funny. They were just a little too ironic for my taste. And so I got really worried when I read that. You know, it's not as bad as, like, you know, Batman the TV series, you know, in that regard. But there were a couple parts where it kind of came close. Like I said, it is a good story. I just really wasn't expecting a laugh that early out of the gate. High points for me, as I said, Vilar Kaftan's story, the Dan Abnett story at the very end, the Frost Giants Data, was spectacular. Dan Abnett's very good at these wonderful little standalone, high-concept action pieces that really build. Like you said, the Tobias Buckell was just great. I was kind of stunned by that. And the one right after that by Becky Chambers I really liked, too. The Universe Sung in Stars was a reprint, I believe, as well. I'm sorry. By Cat Howard, which I loved when I first listened to it on the Lightspeed podcast. As a volume of the deep end of SF, part of it is crazy space opera, part of it is, you know, just cosmic weirdness. And there is a degree in some of the stories, especially the Captain and, to an extent, Cat Howard story. There's a little bit of the new weird creeping in as well. Which is fully fitting when you're trying to tell a widescreen cosmic tale. And being able to do it with the discipline of shorter works is commendable. But it is, it's a volume definitely well worth your while. I highly enjoyed it. And since it seemed the timing of its release was almost like he was doing the smart thing and trying to come in right before Guardians opened to try to, you know, open the mind to those kind of tales, really work. Yeah, Carl Schroeder, Cameron Hurley's in it, Jack Campbell. Yeah, really good lineups and really good pieces.
I mean, I would love to get that cover as a poster.
Yeah.
And I mean, oddly enough, you like the first story and your criticisms, but if you had this written by Peter F. Hamilton, could he have compressed it in that short a space?
He's written, you know, Blessed by an Angel and stuff like that. All got pretty cosmic pretty quickly.
I just find even his short stories are pretty long.
No, I hear you. But, like, you know, look at his, like, Watching Trees Grow by him, which goes from a fairly mundane alt history seed to a sprawling type of concept, sort of like an Ian McDonald story almost.
Yeah.
And it sort of played around with things in that nature. But yeah, I could probably see him doing something in a comparable word count. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I thought that story probably could have been a touch shorter than it actually was. But like I said, you get to page two, and there was an eye roll from me. It pulled out of a dive. Don't get me wrong. I did enjoy it, and there were some parts that I genuinely laughed at. But it was almost an episode of Red Dwarf as opposed to Galactus and the Celestials. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that it struck me more as snark and irony than comedy. I was a little hurt by that, but as anthologies goes, yeah, it's right up there. It stands there with the new space opera collections and the Infinity collections of our friend Mr. Strong. Mm-hmm. And we're having really good stuff.
Yep, definitely. But,
so yes, our heads were all in cosmic spaces.
Move on to culture consumed in general.
Yeah.
But I think that's as far as we overlap. So, John, anything from you this time?
Let's see.
Or should I go to Jeff and let you think?
I can do it.
Okay, good.
Just not very much.
That's okay.
Unless
we've got the other half of this podcast that we recorded in the past, which will fall into the future, so we're good.
I understand. No, I did read quite a lot of the Amulet graphic novel series with my daughter, which was cool.
Like those. Yeah, those are nice. I love those.
Yeah, they're fun. And it was maybe a little mature for her once in a while, but she loves the main character so much, and she likes, you know, the little robot creatures so much that she really blows through it.
How many volumes is that up to now? Do you remember?
Seven?
Wow.
It's I think seven has come out and there's another one coming.
Hmm.
Yeah, one of the things that make me glad she likes it is that it is such a long story. And she's so used to reading really short stuff or books that are a little more episodic, like we've read all the Zeta the Space Girl volumes, but
right.
They're not a coherent story. They're a bunch of different stories that have sort of an arc underneath them, but it's a very sort of dissolved arc. But Amulet really builds and builds and goes on, and you stick with characters for a long time. And I think this is the first thing she's read that has done that. And I'm glad that she appreciates it. But I mean, she's done this with shows like TV and such shows for a couple years, where she's a huge Avatar fan. And she's now reading some of the comics. We got The Rift. Is it The Rift? I think it's The Rift. The big splashy hardcover,
mm-hmm.
which she's now read like four times in the last 7 weeks. And we found a couple of the other comics, parts of them that she's read too. So she loves that stuff. She's a humongous Squirrel Girl fan. So we've read the Squirrel Girl, the first two volumes a couple of times. Is there another one out yet? I don't know for sure.
I don't think there is. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, not yet. So we read and enjoyed those. She's read a little bit of DC's superhero, like, Girl Squad,
mm-hmm.
which is like this improbable comic where Wonder Woman and Supergirl are the same age, and Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn are good guys.
No, oh, look, I mean, you know, if that's the most improbable thing about it, yeah.
But she doesn't like it as much because she likes, I've discovered, she actually likes characters of different ages.
Mm-hmm.
So she's never caught on to, say, the Powerpuff Girls, because she feels that they're all the same. But something like, say, the Ramona books, where there are adults as well as kids of different ages, she loves a lot. So, but in terms of sort of more genre-ish stuff, we've been reading a lot of that, and she's definitely turning into a genre reader, and that's of course gratifying, but it also means I've read stuff that I wouldn't have normally read, like the Amulet books. I don't think I would have normally picked up. But so that's been a lot of my reading for the past few months is with her. And I have also read some more, you know, hermit poetry. Shockingly. I've now got a stack of like 8 books to read, and I've just gone through some more of the Mountain Poems of Stonehouse, and I can't remember the poet's name, but another one of these Chinese poets from the classical period who worked as a bureaucrat for 30 years and then fell out of favor and got exiled and decided, well, I'm exiled, I'll become a hermit poet now. And then wrote poetry for the rest of his life. So I'm going through some of that stuff, and I'm actually trying to find out more about the history of that sort of long period of poets that I've been reading. But I've also read parts of Jeff Vandermeer's Wonder Book, which I will confess I had never read before.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I think what may have put me off from it is that as I've gotten older, I've just kind of gotten tired of writing advice books because I feel like I know a little bit about writing and I've been doing it for a long time. So it just doesn't, you know, sort of invigorate me the way that it did when I started writing. But, you know, Wonder Book, as you well know, is just a beautiful, you know, event. It's like an experience to read Wonder Book.
It's not just a bunch of dry advice.
It's not just make sure to dot your I's and cross your T's.
Yeah,
exactly. It's it really reflects Vandermeer's not just process but the way his imagination works, which is
personality, definitely.
There's definitely a lot of his personality in there too. So that's been fun to read bits and pieces of. And I've also been working my way through a little Heinlein.
Uh-oh.
I just started rereading Time for the Stars, which is sort of like my third or fourth favorite Heinlein.
Mm.
I've always been really most attracted to his Juveniles and Time for the Stars was one that really, for some reason, really just sort of caught my attention when I was a kid. And I must have read it a dozen times in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what it is about that story that speaks to me. But it does. And it was always a comfort read for me. And coming back to it now after not having read it for a quarter century, it's interesting to see what I recall of my older reactions to it, and also just evaluating it now as an older reader.
Yeah, I started rereading those last year and I finished Farmer in the Sky, so I guess Time for the Stars would be the next in the series. Yeah, so hopefully mm-hmm. we'll get to that soon. I think the one I read the most of was Have Space Suit Will Travel. I don't know mm-hmm. how many times I read that one. Man. That and Starman Jones. Because Starman Jones and Farmer mm-hmm. in the Sky were both sold. We in Teaneck, New Jersey, we had this once a year bookmobile would come. And those were the two titles that they sold by Heinlein. So I read those two titles until they fell apart.
Of course. Now, Farmer's Sky is another one of my favorites. But I read Time for the Stars a lot, and for some reason I read Space Cadet a lot.
Yep.
Which was actually very attractive to my health in high school, walking around with a book that called Space Cadet.
I
had one of the older hardcovers too, so it was in big letters on the cover mm-hmm. and really prominent, you know, on the spine. So I acquired a nickname as a result of that, which was better than some of the other things.
It's
I was
so called. Weird because when I was younger, uh-huh. I think I read most of the later Heinlein first.
Uh-huh.
There was that Book of Future History short stories, that big fat
Pass Through Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Well, the first two I read were, believe it or not, Stranger in a Strange Land and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah, before I didn't read those until
any of the YA stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, for me, yeah. For me, it was really what my library had in stock at first. Yep. So they had all the juveniles. So I read those, and then they got a copy of Stranger in a Strange Land, so I read that, and I couldn't believe it was written by the same person. And also being like 14 when I read it, and being who I was at the time, it was very sort of shocking, even though it's a pretty mild book for most of it. But so I've been doing that. I've been occasionally reading Highland Juvenile, and I think part of it's with an eye towards, you know, my daughter's reading in the future too, because it's like, you know, what would I recommend to her? You know, there's so much I wouldn't recommend, and it's like, so what do I recommend? You know, where should I point her? And I can just point her right to Le Guin and say, go to town, because she needs, you know, more than that. So I've read that, and I've read some comics, and I haven't finished most of them, so I don't think they really count. I've read a couple of the newer Batman titles in graphic novel format, and couldn't get past the second or third story. And then I read one Superman thing, and I barely even remember what the creative team was, because I read the first issue was like, I just can't read this crap anymore.
Tom King's been Batman, so.
So that's been my culture consumed, basically. I've got some good stuff up in queue. I'm going to read Born here pretty quick because I just got it. And I also just got Paul Kincaid's Ian M. Banks book.
Yes.
For the Masters.
Well. Yep.
So I'm gonna tuck into that. I have been pleasantly surprised by the last four Masters books because they've really raised my my admiration for the series. They've just been like so much better than some of the early books, and they just seem to be finding the perfect author to write about a particular author. So it, you know, Edward James's Bejeweled volume was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Jerry Canavan's Octavia Butler book was also fantastic in a somewhat different way. But what I think the trend that I see that I'm liking is that the authors of the volumes are giving a little more insight into why they like the books.
Yes, yes.
Mm. Whereas in the first few volumes, certainly, it was just very, tended a very dry kind of academic approach that mm-hmm. just didn't work because you weren't getting a sense of why the author decided to write about this person. It's like when you decide to write a whole volume about someone's writing, you should probably, you know, have some good reason to do it. And what I found, and certainly the last couple volumes that I've read, last three or four, is that the reason is they admire the writer and they want to. But they don't want to just laud them. They want to engage their work.
I mean, that's...
And say what works and what doesn't.
You know,
and
the Gibson one was the example of the academic one. And I think the series terrible. Changed with friend of the pod, terrible. Karen Burnham, and the Greg Egan
yep.
volume. That was the one that really turned it around for me. And it's been going up mm-hmm. ever since.
That was the first one in the series that I really liked was Karen's book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, for the most part, it has definitely gone up since then. And certainly the last, like, four books I've read, or three books I've read, have been great.
Yep.
And I'm looking forward to reading the Kincaid one, because he is a very academic reviewer. And I'm curious how his approach is going to... If his approach is going to shift somewhat into a more personal mode, or, you know, how he's going to approach Banks. And,
Well, if nothing else, I think, you know, he admires him, so...
No, definitely. And like yeah. I said, I think, you know, that is kind of necessary. You have to have some kind of, you know, durable reason to engage you know, a writer's body of work.
Yeah.
And with, for example, the Gibson volume, you know, Gary Westfall, it just sounded like he could barely tolerate Gibson's work. And that doesn't make a good book. It doesn't make a good book of criticism. It doesn't make a good, you know, book of analysis. It doesn't make a good book even of a descriptive nature.
Yeah, I mean, I like Westfall in general, but that one, it wouldn't be the first one to save when the house caught on fire, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'd probably throw it in and say, feed the flames, my darling. But, so, you know, like I said, there's some good stuff coming up, and I will now have more time to read stuff, you know, from my humongous to-be-read pile, so I'm looking forward to that, too.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah.
Jeff, or do you want me to go?
Yeah, I got a couple things to talk about. I mentioned before a comic called God Country, which is now up to 5 issues, Donnie Cates and Jeff Shaw, with Jason Wordy doing a spectacular job with the coloring. It's a very interesting story about a old man who lives out in the Midwest, in farm country, with his family living not too close, fairly close to him, who is slowly succumbing to dementia and one day finds a giant sword which talks to him. And it turns out that the sword belongs to a war god, and the war god wants it back. And the war god comes to take it back and fails, and so the war god's father decides to start sending other emissaries to get the sword back. This series has been, number one, very exciting. The action scenes have been good. The interaction with the family has been good. The fact that the guy does not want to give up the sword because that means his dementia will kick in again are all very interesting takes on the, you know, your magical MacGuffin-based fantasy. I think the interesting thing, there's supposed to be one more issue of this book, and I think what interests me the most is that it's been so good and so fulfilling so far that there's very few outcomes that I can think of for this book that would really be disappointing, because it carries this kind of little thread of tragedy through the whole thing, and it's been very, very enjoyable. Another one, it's on the second issue now, that's another intriguing idea, is the book is called World Reader. It's by Jeff Loveness is the writer, Juan Doe is the artist, and it comes out from Aftershock Comics. And it's kind of a clever idea that would have worked in something like Black Science or some of the other kind of trippier SF books. And it's a ship of people that are going around and they're exploring old planets, trying to find things valuable that they can exploit. And they have with them a world reader who basically goes down to the planet and can divine through a psychic ability, cosmic intuitiveness, whatever, how the world died. And what's happened so far is that she's done this a few times, and the captain of the ship really doesn't like having her on, but I guess it's some kind of a regulation. And she goes to this one planet, and she finds out that these people were killed, and she sort of starts to see through their collective memories the entity that killed them, which we really don't have a good idea of yet. And it seems to be kind of this, you know, malicious Thanos-type character, but it really hasn't been developed yet. And in the 2 issues so far, it's basically her deciding, you know what, I'm going to break a whole bunch of regulations, put on my spacesuit and go down there and try to figure out what the hell's going on, because I think all of our civilization is endangered by it. And it's a clever little, it's one of those books that, like I've said about Lucifer and other books, it tells a very big story through a very small focus. And it came out of nowhere. I had no idea this book was about to come out, and it's been spectacular so far. Speaking of Lucifer, I really want to give a thumbs up to Richard Kadrey, who's been doing a great job with the book. Better than I expected. Taking sort of a completely different take on it, and really making it work. One other thing I want to mention, in the latest issue of Heavy Metal, issue number 286, there is a essay by Mr. Grant Morrison called Beyond the Word and the Fool Heavy Metals Magic Primer. And this is basically Morrison's take on what magic means now in the present day, in the 21st century, in the world that we live in. And in short, he is basically saying that the mind confers meaning upon matter, so that it's significance that is actually the root of magic, not necessarily naming and identity and threads of continuity, but actually the significance that is imbued by something and how much it matters. And it's interesting reading this, because I've been reading a lot of really strange science stories lately, where Eon Magazine has put out, you know, articles about reality seems to be more than the sum of its parts, and people writing essays about the role of consciousness in evolution and in studies of reality in and of itself, physics and quantum phenomena. And this reads very much like that. And if this essay had been printed in fantasy and science fiction, or in Interzone, or any more recognized venue for the aficionados of the fantastic, I think it would cause a bit of a buzz, if not a stir, and would certainly lead to a great deal of debate. But since heavy metal in and of itself tends to exist beyond the horizon for most of fandom, which is too bad, because it's a nice piece, and I'm hoping that he's going to expand on it a little bit. And it's actually a bit more an intriguing read than his book on comics that came out a few years ago, which I thought was almost an apologetic, where this is definitely something that he's put a lot of thought into. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. Two books I do want to mention. Number one, Poppy Z. Bright, Used Stories, which I think came out, I don't know the year of publication, 2004. And it looks like an e-copy came out last year in 2016. It is a collection of five stories: Toxic Wastrels, Homewrecker, Essence of Rose, Nailed, and The Goose Girl. I had read Homewrecker and Nailed. I had never read the other three. Essence of Rose is spectacular. I've always been a huge Poppy Z. Bright fan, and it's almost like a comfort food for me when I go back and start reading her stuff. This was a one Independent Legions Publishing put this out, and they put out several collections of her stuff. I'm going to try to that. She also did a novella called The Crystal Empire, which came out last year, which I have not read, but she also has a Selected Stories edition with them. And speaking of novellas, where did I put it? There is a Come and See the Living Dryad by Theodora Goss, which came out from Tor. I really liked this whole singles release thing that Tor is doing has been, yep, very good so far, and has had a very good success rate.
Yes, definitely.
I've been enjoying that. And one piece that I've read that doesn't really fall into the fantastic, but it does when it comes to character building, is the new book by Dennis Lehane, who wrote things like Mystic River and Shutter Island and Gone By and Gone Baby Gone. And he did some writing for things like Boardwalk Empire and The Wire. He's written a fairly interesting story about a very damaged woman who accumulated this damage through childhood from having a fairly famous mother who wrote a kind of a half-hearted self-help book that kind of, you know, pushed her into the spotlight with the Dr. Phil crowd about dealing with relationships. And as a result, she kind of almost used her daughter as a social experiment. And after the mother dies, you think the story is going to be about the girl searching for her father. But in fact, the story really doesn't pull together till the second half, when it turns out that the man that she ends up marrying, the second husband, there are some incongruities in their life together, which she really won't let go of. And she makes a few very clever observations and realizes that her life is not exactly what it seems to be. I liked it a lot because, number one, Lehane is such a great writer when it comes to descriptions, especially when he's doing first-person narratives. He's so just utterly lyrical and manages to do it without bringing in a lot of metaphors. And so when he does bring one in, it hits like a power chord and really resonates. And on top of that, there's the fact that this place takes place over a period of years in different phases of her life, and the fact that all of those phases sort of begin coming together, and you don't realize that you've been picking up speed as you go until you realize you're going too fast to control it, was really intriguing, and I'm certain I'll make a movie out of it. And while it's not science fiction or fantasy, it does play with the concept of the other, in the fact that the protagonist really views herself as being outside of the events of her life. And until she starts realizing that she's going to have to get more involved with it, she's got anxiety issues and a few other things, one by one, which she overcomes in one manner or another. But it was really good. I read it in about 2 days. It was very intriguing. It's a very fast read. It's probably one of the better books that I've read. And I just started the Road to Science Fiction, Volume 1 by James Gunn, or he's editing it, called From Gilgamesh to Wells.
Right.
Just started that. And there are a lot of essays in here by a lot of different people throughout history.
Now, is that a new edition? I mean, are they back out again, or?
Let me see. Let me check copyright.
Because I have like three different publishers to make a complete set.
Scarecrow reprint 2002.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's the latest date on here. It came out in 77.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, pretty interesting. You know, a lot of this stuff I have read, but the fact that he's curating these selections from various pieces, each one sort of making a point. It's just intriguing reading a take on the history of SF that sort of plays with the specificity of themes as opposed to the overarching sort of a grand vision of the canon or whatever. I don't know how many of these I actually read all together, but I do remember I did have some hardcovers of them. But yeah, it's kind of neat, you know, talking about, you know, Jonathan Swift and dealing with things like Descent, and talking about Nathaniel Hawthorne when you're talking about symbolism and modernism. Pretty neat take. It was almost a palate cleanser after all the cosmic stuff that we've been dallying with lately. So, And that's been about it for me. I got a few things that I'm going to start this week, hopefully, that I want to get through.
Mm-hmm. Well, on my end, in addition to what we've already discussed, I reread High Justice by Jerry Pournelle, which is a collection of short stories, usually hinted as being all part of the same universe as his Codomitium stuff, but not really. Mm-hmm. So those were first time I've read them in a long time, and he's a lot more conservative than I remember him being. So either I've become more liberal or he's become crankier. I'm not sure which way we're all running. And then
why not both?
That's true. And then as part of a bigger project, which may be announced sometime later this year, I reread Vic and Blood by Harlan Ellison, and once again got very irritated at the end of the book, in which he has an essay, and he talks about, yes, the novel is almost done. It'll be out any second now. It's sitting right here. Here's an excerpt, and I'll, you know, it's going to come out. And I'm like, yeah. I mean, there... I wrote a blog post once in which I had listed all the various books announced by various people that never came out. And he didn't have the largest number of entries, but Harlan definitely has irritated me because I've always wanted to read that book, and I've always wanted to read his Demon with the Glass Hand novel that he announced freaking decades ago. I mean, guys, you know, you complain about George R. R. Martin. At least he's still writing in the universe. He doesn't dangle a Demon with a Glass Hand novel in front of you and never come out with it. Because, I mean, Demon with a Glass Hand was an episode of Outer Limits, which I believe first broadcast in 1963. That is my first science fictional memory, because I saw that on first run TV with my mother. And for years, I didn't know what it was. I just had the vision of Robert Culp and that talking to that glass hand. I never knew what it was connected to. I just always had that vision. My mother could remember it. I had no idea if it actually was just a real thing or not. And then when I came across it, like in the 1980s or whatever, I'm like, this is it. This is the thing. Started it all. So, you know, Harlan, you're still around. Finish that damn book. And then in preparation for the new season of Twin Peaks, I burned through the first season of Twin Peaks like in 2 days, which isn't that hard because it's only like, I think, 8 episodes plus the pilot. And now I'm about halfway through the second season because I have not seen that since it was first on. And then I'm going to watch Fargo Walk with Me. I've listened to the tapes, the Diane tapes by Agent Cooper. And I'm now listening to the audio book of the Laura Palmer diary. And now I'm in the middle of about 8 million Twin Peaks podcasts, including, let's see, the Twin Peaks Rewatch, one called, what the hell is this? It's based on the streets in one of those episodes. Fire Talk with Me is another one. Twin Peaks Unwrapped and Twin Peaks Entertainment or something like that. And some of them are good, some of them are bad, some of them have some really good background, but man, people do like to talk about Twin Peaks. And that's where I am. So, folks, that's about all for this part of the episode. Stay tuned, either right after I stop speaking or in the second half of this episode, which will drop separately, depending on how long we all end up on the cutting room floor. And we have lots of good things coming in the next few months. So from me, Jeff, and John, have a good night from the Three Horsemen or the Cursed Horsemen, depending on how you look at it. Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and it is time for another episode of The Three Horsemen. First of all, let me introduce, as always, co-host and the man who does the footwork behind this podcast, Mr. Fred Kish.
Hi, this is Fred Kish. I'm FredKish11 on Twitter, and boy, my feet are tired from all the footwork I've been doing trying to herd cats who won't stick to their recording dates. But that's another story.
I hear that. It's going to be another fun summer on the Three Horsemen trying to get this stuff, trying to get all the stars to align.
We're not talking about tonight's guest, though.
Of course not. So, if any of you have been following me, Jeff Patterson, JeffPatterson11 on Twitter or on Facebook, you know that I have been crowing about having a story in an anthology called World's Enough, Volume 1, Fantastic Defenders. And I would be remiss in my role as host of this podcast if I did not talk to some of the people who were behind that. We've got three of them with us tonight. We've got the co-editors. Say hello, Mr. David Keener.
Hi, everybody.
And his partner in crime on the editing end of things was Miss Donna Royston.
Hi.
And the publisher of this endeavor, Mr. Martin Wilsey.
Greetings, humans.
How are you all doing tonight?
Excellent.
So I was very, very excited when Dave invited me to be part of this course, he asked for a fantasy story, and I had no idea what I was going to write about when he asked that. But this is volume one of anthology line that they called World's Enough. And Dave, I wanted to ask you first, when you first pitched this to me, or when you first invited me to contribute something, you sort of had a pretty clear idea of what you wanted to do with this line. Why don't you tell us what that was all about?
Well, I'd had the idea in mind for a while. I wanted to do an anthology series where I could do different volumes on different subjects, ranging from fantasy like the first one to science fiction for the next one. Since I didn't know a lot of writers and I didn't know a lot of people at first, I kind of put the idea on hold for a while, but then our writing group kind of expanded, took off a little bit. You were a member of our writing group for a while. And I found that I knew enough people to actually fill an anthology. I knew enough good writers that I could do that. I didn't necessarily want like 10 or 12 or 16 stories. I like novelettes. So I looked around and I said, well, who can do a good solid novelette? And I figured five novelettes would make a nice volume. I found four writers off the bat that I thought could do the work. And then we opened up the final slot with an open call.
This was your first time actually tackling something like this, where you have to curate disparate voices into a single thing. Was that function what you expected it to be?
I've done a little bit of editing in the past. It was in a different venue back during the days of the internet boom. I ran a staff of writers for a job hunting site. Mm-hmm. So I was used to dealing with multiple writers. Obviously, writing job-related feature articles is different than getting some stories ready for a collection. So I think I picked a bunch of really professional people who gave me all the help that I could possibly have expected with that. I think the biggest challenge was just the amount of work that needed to be done, and it coincided with a promotion at work, which cost me a lot of time out of my schedule.
So, Donna, you got roped into this, obviously. How deeply do you regret it?
Oh, not at all. I mean, you know, it's like I've been an editor for most of my professional life, and it was such a relief to be able to do something fun. Instead of, you know, technical papers. And I guess the least technical stuff that I've done was years ago when I actually wrote some articles for my employer's newsletter on various topics. But mostly, you know, I've just been an editor and edited scientific papers and sociological papers and actuarial science papers, so, you know, doing fiction. Oh, man. Jump at the chance.
You both, Dave and Donna, both gave me some great advice on my story, The Iron Garden. And I'm just kind of curious, did you find you had to dole out more advice than you were expecting when it came to the stories involved?
Jeff, I think you're a great writer. All your stories I have admired. you know, I have great respect for your ability to conceptualize this big picture and get it into, you know, a coherent story. I had the least amount of comments for yours as anyone's.
And I had comments for him, though.
Yeah.
but again, I think your story was, for instance, solid all the way through. The things that I was editing for were not so much the structure of your story, but to just make sure that things were set up for the reader so that you were leaving proper breadcrumbs for them and that they could follow the story along really well, because it is a complex story. But the bones were always there.
Well, I appreciate that.
And for your first foray into fantasy, I thought you did pretty good.
I knew you could do it.
Well, I want to talk about that in a minute. So, Marty, I want to talk about Tannhauser Press with you, which is the imprint for this, because that started off as your outlet for self-publishing, mostly your Solstice 31 stories. And it has now sort of blossomed into a full-blown small press.
The whole reason it exists is because I started making money on my books, you know, and it suddenly I was like, oh my God, what do I do? Because, you know, I was completely clueless. I was just making everything up as I went along. And finally, I actually was having a meeting with my financial advisor. This is like my retirement counselor for my 401ks and stuff. And I started showing her the stuff about my writing and royalties and the royalty checks I've been getting from all around the world and stuff like that, and the amount of money that I was bringing in. And I was really afraid at that point about taxes. And she says to me, dude, you need an accountant. So she recommended an accountant. I go and visit the accountant, bring all my receipts and all the expenses and everything and royalty statements and all of that. And she looks at me and she goes, dude, you need a lawyer. So she recommended a lawyer that had experience in copyright-related issues and stuff. And I had a meeting with him, and he is the one that was actually marked the genesis for the creation of Tannhauser Press. It turns out that in the publishing world, there's a lot of advantages to actually having a small press for a new author, and they're so easy to set up. Well, easy if you're a lawyer. And so he gave me a lot of really good advice about how to set it up, the advantages about having it, the fact that I would be able to be the president and CEO of my own LLC that's taxed as an S corp, whatever that means. And suddenly Tannhauser Press was born. And the next thing you know, I found that, you know, there was a lot of advantages to, like, block purchasing a mass amount of ISBN numbers and being able to give other authors a leg up and help them figure out and navigate the process for being a self-published or an indie-published author. And it's turned out that I've got a lot of people that have been contributing and helping with it, editors and illustrators and people that, you know, do things like formatting and other things. And the work with the anthologies through the writers group actually has really been great as well. The anthologies that our writers group also uses Tannhauser Press as the small press venue. I don't know if that begins to answer your question. That's how the whole thing came about. And then, you know, once it actually became a thing, and once it actually had a real website, once people actually were starting to send submissions to me, and it started to become real, not just me using it as a guy with a credit card to, you know, best serve him, his own self. Suddenly I'm able to help out other authors as we go.
That's great. That's so great. I love hearing stories like that.
Yeah, and it's actually working out really good. And as far as World's Enough goes, I was a contributing author for it. I am normally a hard science fiction author. All my novels that I've published so far have been the hard science fiction avenue. I really enjoyed going into the swords and sorcery genre to actually contribute one of the chapters. I have a story in there called The Once Damned, and I had so much fun writing that story. I'll probably end up writing some real full-blown fantasy novels at some point in the future.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because one of the things that happened to me was we've talked about John DiNardo on this show, who ran SF Signal, and he had asked me to write a column regarding the state of Marvel Comics, and one of the things I said near the beginning of that column was the fact that Marvel's been around so long, and it and DC Comics sort of stand alone in their ability to mix science fictional and fantasy elements with equal measure. And as an example, I made a point that, you know, you're never going to see a Berserker probe land on a Westeros. That's actually sort of the genesis of the Iron Garden, was me overthinking that line and trying to figure out how I could how many science fictional elements I could actually incorporate into a fantasy story in a fantasy way without it actually sort of breaking a genre wall, how many I could actually translate into a fantasy equivalent. And
it worked for me, Jeff.
And that sort of became the game for me as I put this thing together. And I felt horrible because they had asked for, you guys had asked for 10 to 20,000 words, and I got it down to 28. And I said, I think it's too long. And you were like, no, everybody else came in short. So Fred.
Yep.
We've talked to a lot of different people involving publishing and stuff like that. And I'm just curious if you got any insight into methods and procedures when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Well, I'm just curious to see. I mean, you're all, at least until Jeff went south, or more south, you're all in the same writing group, I believe, right?
Correct.
I mean, how are you doing advertising or spreading word of mouth beyond the local group?
Well, we have definitely encountered the discoverability problem. You are helping us to solve that, actually. But really, I think, you know, we're using Twitter, we're using Facebook. I just handed out a bunch of free copies to to some members of the Washington Science Fiction Association, who are, you know, fairly well known in science fiction circles in this area. We're starting to get some Amazon reviews out there. You know, it's gonna take a little while. I don't expect to, you know, unless something goes viral, which I'm always happy if it does. But I expect this to be a long burn, and we're just going to keep pushing at the marketing. It's a learning experience for us too.
You guys just went to a Balticon, right?
Yes, we did.
Yep.
And how was that?
Oh gosh, that was a lot of fun. I was on. This is Dave Keener. I was on programming at Balticon. I think I had 8 hours of public speaking that I did.
Yikes.
It was a lot of fun being on, you know, the other side, talking to the audience. I think my high point was I got to moderate a panel with Jack Campbell, otherwise known as John Himry, on one side of me, and Stephen Brust on the other side.
Ooh. Wow.
You know, one's a, you know, the first is a, you know, New York Times bestselling writer, and you know, Stephen Brust is one of the, you know, top fantasists in the field. That was pretty amazing to me.
Awesome.
And he did a great job too.
So the other thing I wanted to ask was, you know, you talked a little bit about switching up genres and stuff like that for future volumes. If reality was no object, where would you see, you know, Worlds Enough going as a series?
Well, tentatively, my model is to perhaps do an anthology per year in this series. The next one that I want to do is Worlds Enough 2 is going to be about future crimes. So where the first volume was fantasy, the second one will be science fiction.
Something else I wanted to mention, Donna had yet to express how impressed I was with your introduction to the volume.
Thank you.
You took a very interesting take on the concept of defending and the nature of virtue. And I was just kind of curious. Could you sort of like just encapsulate that for us, what your approach was in doing that intro?
Well, it was also worth it just to have Clarence the Angel, Beowulf, and a child born in a peach combined in one essay.
That's a super team right there.
That's the next Marvel spinoff.
Well, I just started thinking about, you know, defenders, specifically ones that were fantastic. I mean, you can think of historical ones too, but it just, you know, I just started running through stories in my head, and for some reason, Momotaro was the first one that came in. Besides Beowulf, and I'm like, you know, there's a lot of similarities between Momotaro and Beowulf. It's kind of strange to say that, but it is. And you know, defenders are people that are, in real life, are quite extraordinary, and we love to read about them in fiction, too. You know, you have your dystopias and all that, but really, the defender stories are some of the most fundamental stories that people tell and that seem to stay with us for a long time. And you know, we love Beowulf's monsters and all that, but Beowulf himself, pretty interesting character, mm-hmm. and Clarence is too. He's funny, and yet he still manages to be a defender. And when you start thinking about it, he's really kind of extreme, because what he puts the human that he's defending through is actually pretty harrowing. I don't know how all of those things came together in my mind, but I thought they made an interesting mix.
I'm sure it was the flaming rum punch.
One of my favorite scenes, yeah.
I thought it was the flaming rum punch that you guys were drinking.
Someday I want to try it.
And I do think it's pretty fun. I mean, stories about defenders, the people that keep fighting the good fight no matter what, no matter the odds. I think we all will find those stories fascinating.
Sometimes it can be a form of moral absolutism, or sometimes it can be just being utterly fed up with a given threat, or sometimes it's money. You know, the motivations for that type of character can be widespread. Sometimes it's honor, sometimes it's trying to do the right thing. Now, I know, Dave, you've also got another book that just came out, correct?
That's correct.
Another story. And what's that called?
It's called The Good Book, because I couldn't come up with a better title that was more descriptive of the story.
And that's out now, correct?
It is out.
That is on Amazon, yeah?
In ebook and in print.
Awesome. What's that about?
Well, it's a novelette. And I have a feeling this story is always going to be my outlier, because it's a fantasy, but it's not a high fantasy. It's not an epic fantasy. It's not sword and sorcery. It's not urban fantasy. It's set in the current day. A guy is about to jump off of a bridge when a passing bicyclist hands him a book. It turns out to be a magic book with a bad attitude. And the rest of his day doesn't go the way he expects. It's one of those books that's about, you know, maybe finding a purpose in life. But it's not about fighting trolls or, you know, saving an empire or putting an heir back on the throne. It's a completely different type of story in the modern day.
And Marty, what have you got coming out next?
Well, actually, I'm just about to finish up. In fact, tonight, instead of actually finishing the last 10 pages, I'm talking to you guys.
Okay, I apologize for that. I really
no. Actually, I'll be finishing it up, however long it takes us after we're done here. But that goes to my editor for the final polish tonight. So I fully expect my next novel, Virtues of the Vicious, to be published in the next 2 weeks. I'm very excited about that.
Is that a Solstice 31 story?
It actually is a standalone novel.
Okay.
It does take place in the same universe as the Solstice 31 saga, but 5 years after the events of the trilogy.
Okay.
But it's completely unrelated. You don't have to have read any of the other books in order to get this one. If you read this one first, it'd be a good prerequisite for the other ones. In fact, there's one character in this book that actually was a tertiary character in the Solstice 31 saga. And it's just one of those characters that, you know, end up on the cutting room floor mostly, but I just love the character, and he just would not die, and he just would not Give It Up. So he is one of the main characters in this novel, and I really like his character in it.
All right, so for those of us who have not read it, what is Solstice 31?
Solstice 31 Saga is a trilogy. It's my first venture into the novel writing world. It's about a working stiff, just maintenance guy number 41, who was on a deep space survey ship that they were dropping into orbit to check out a planet to see if it would be appropriate for colonization. And as soon as they go into orbit, the ship is automatically destroyed by an automated defense system they didn't know was there. I'm not giving anything away because that happens in the first paragraph of the book. And this,
so it starts slow.
Yeah, it starts slow. So it's a survival story for the main character, Roland Barkas, who actually manages to survive and get to the surface of this planet. And where he lands on the planet, he discovers suddenly these lands in the middle of a genocide. At the same time, he's trying to figure out who the hell just killed everybody in the known universe that I cared about. So he gets kind of pissed off, and he kind of kills a lot of people. Anyway, it starts out as a simple survival story in the beginning, kind of a Robinson Crusoe kind of survival story in the first novel. And it slowly escalates the mystery of how, why his survey ship was destroyed. It turns out to, he solves that mystery, and it turns out to be a larger conspiracy, and it snowballs by the time he gets back to Earth, and culminates in the death of 115 million people, and hilarity ensues.
As it always does.
As it always does. And it's interesting. I'm not giving anything away. In fact, the Solstice 31 incident is actually kind of a parallel to 9/11. It is a giant thing that happens, is very complicated and has a lot of political implications and stuff like that. But it's on a very, very large scale. And,
yeah, one of the things I always liked about those stories is that you actually managed to show how everything sort of tumbles back to that moment in one way or another, that all the threads are connected with that. I always thought that was rather clever. And I just want to double check. Are all of those books on Audible as well?
Yes.
They are. Okay.
Yes, I have. I really love Audible. I was very lucky in that I, for my first novel, got hooked up with a really good producer. And, you know, I stumbled into all this. I just was, like, so lucky on every front. And a friend of mine recommended, hey, you should try to put this out on audio. People would love this book on audio. And I discovered ACX.com, which is the wholly owned subsidiary for Amazon that drives the Audible works. And I managed to navigate that, and I worked out a deal with a good producer and a good audiobook. A good producer, I've had a lot of conversations with him, and a good producer will actually read your entire book. And what did he call it? He said, oh, when you spot a really good property, is what he called it. And he says, a good property will have legs. Because I was doing a royalty split with him, he was all in. And in fact, he not only was all in on the first one, he signed up for all three of them. And it turned out that now I sell a lot of audiobooks. I sell more audiobooks than I sell paper books, in fact. Kindle's still the big winner. But, man, I make a bunch of money on Audible. I love Audible. And as soon as I get this press published on Virtues of the Vicious, I am going to put an open call out for another producer and voice talent for the Audible edition of this novel. And I can't wait for that.
Wow.
I had a... Now, for the stories that have appeared in here, are any of these part of a larger universe or either something that's been written in the past or that you now plan to continue on? Because, I mean, everything, I've only gotten about 60% of the way through the book, but each of the stories I've read so far, I would have liked to have read something else in that same universe. except for Jeff's, you know.
Ouch.
Well, I plan on actually creating an entire novel that's associated with the main character that I had in my story that appears in World Enough. And in that case, World's Enough is going to be an excellent leg up into the novel that I plan on writing. I've already got a pretty solid outline for the story, in fact. And it's there's a lot of unanswered questions and by the end of the short story that's in the anthology. But it's just enough taster to actually feed my brain for a whole novel. It's going to be great. It's going to be so much fun.
And for me, my story is set in a venue that I call the Thousand Kingdoms. So that is essentially a universe in which I've set up a bunch of my stories. And it's set up so that characters cross over into each other's stories and everything. So you'll definitely see more stories in that universe and more stories about my royal bodyguard as well.
Well, I appreciate a person who uses urine as a weapon, so. There you go.
Hey, it was the shortest fight I could come up with.
Hey, it was great. It was great.
There's a bit of urine in my story as well. Maybe that should be the theme for the next volume.
Finding theme.
Yeah.
Well, for mine, about Sun Cho in 4th century China, I do have one other story, which was the first story in the series. I'm not sure if I'll write more, but I will be... toying with the idea.
I hear there's this anthologist guy that's going to keep pushing you to write more stories about him.
I do enjoy the two that I've already written. I really like the way they came out.
Are you guys starting to see how I push people along?
Oh my God, he's starting to sound like Patrick Hester. I don't know if I can take this. During the editing process, I told Donna that I had probably cut about 6 scenes out of my outline for the final version of Iron Garden. We originally saw a lot more of the house. I had sort of wanted to make the house a bit more of a character in the story than it already was. But I had a choice as to whether to bring the city to life a bit more or the house, and I went with the city, and I'm glad I did. But there's probably a 40,000-word version of the Iron Garden somewhere in me. Whether or not I'm going to do it or not, I don't know. But I've actually had a couple people ask me if I'm going to do any more stories about Igenia and Kareed and Ogin. And I don't know. I mean, it was fun, but I sort of was trying to bring something to a definitive end with it.
I think you can do more in that series. Yeah. In fact, if you write it, I'll find an anthology to put it in.
Well, it's definitely on my list, but my to-do list is very long right now. So,
well, fantastical houses are very fun.
Yes. So,
if not that one, maybe another.
Yep. So we have a little thing we do here called Culture Consume, where we ask everybody that we have on if there's anything they've read or seen or watched or experienced of the SF world that's been on their radar, really got their attention, or that they're really enjoyed. I know you talked a little bit about Balticon, but I'm just kind of curious if anybody, you know, what's been on the forefront of your mind when it comes to the genre lately that you've really enjoyed. Why don't I start with Donna on this?
What I've read most recently has been Jack Campbell's new book, Vanguard.
Mm.
I thought it was very good. He still manages to come up with new stuff and some surprises. I always like a book that focuses on one character, you know, and his trials and tribulations all the way through, his or her. Vanguard is not that book. It's following 3 different parties of people, but nevertheless, I was hooked throughout the whole story. I thought it was really good.
Cool. Dave, how about you?
Well, I'm enjoying Kim Stanley Robinson's New York 2140 right now. I ended up buying a signed copy of that at Balticon.
And Marty?
I'm currently just about to finish one of Jim Butcher's novels called The Aeronauts Windless. This is a new steampunk novel that he's written. It's a beginning of the Cinder series. And I haven't read much steampunk at all, and I just love this thing. I mean, it's really, really fun. It's lots of good action adventure. You know, it's part pirates, part, you know, aliens, part dirigibles, part, you know, and the world building that he has in it is really good, and I love it. And so far, so good. This is one of his series that I'll probably eat like I ate all the Dresden File books.
Mm.
It's been a while. You know, I've been wondering where the next book in that series is, and I'm not sure when or if ever it's going to arrive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how long you wait for a book, and then I read it one day. It's like, yeah. Oh, man, yeah. I got to, like, pace myself.
Fred, how about you?
Well, I used most of my recent reads in our other session, but I can't talk about my daughter, who, oh my God, is graduating from high school in 2 weeks, but now she is reading Dune, Desert Planet, Arrakis, Spice. Ooh. And I also am trying her on not American Gods. She read American Gods, and now she's. I gave her the Pratchett Gaiman collaboration. And I also bought her Pattern Recognition by William Gibson, figuring that's a good science fiction look at the real world, or the real world through science fiction eyes. So I want to see how she likes Gibson. Mm. So my quest to create the next generation continues.
Mm. I started going through some of the collected short stories of Robert Silverberg. It was quite a few of his really early pulp pieces that I hadn't read, and I'm slowly making my way through that. But the book that's really surprised the hell out of me is China Mieville has done October, A Story of the Russian Revolution, which is basically a narrative about the overthrow of Tsarist Russia. And it is probably stylistically, I think it's probably some of his best writing so far. I'm just really liking the pacing of it and the little sub-threads, especially all the various actions and counteractions that were occurring before the actual revolution took place. About halfway through it, just really, really fascinating. It's as fascinating as reading a fantasy story from him, and the way he really brings his language together and stuff like that. And it has the same almost absurdity as something like The City in the City by him, where everything is just so utterly counterintuitive. It's just nuts. All right, this is awesome. So the book is called World's Enough, Volume 1, Fantastic Defenders. Got a guy holding a sword on the cover in the snow. Very, very stark, very valiant. And aside from blowing my own horn, I really recommend it because all the stories in there are just fantastic. Folks, I want to thank you for being on.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Not a problem. Not a problem. And until next time, this is me and Fred saying good evening.
Good night.